Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment. Master Commissioner Gregory Matthews presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning. On the docket this morning is case number 2016-568, Harrah's Ohio Acquisition Company, LLC versus Cuyahoga County Board of Revision. For the appellant, Mr. Conzer.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Thomas A. Conzer. I'm counsel for the Warrensville Heights Board of Education in these proceedings. As this court is aware, this is a case is an appeal from the Ohio Board of Tax Appeals from an order setting the real estate tax valuation for the Thistledown Racino, which is a thoroughbred horse racing facility located in Cuyahoga County. As of April of 2013, the location also had a license to conduct video lottery gaming and commence video lottery gaming at the facility. This particular parcel of property was before the Board of Tax Appeals and before this court on two previous occasions, one for the 2010 tax year and one for the 2012 tax year. In each of those cases, the Board of Education relied on a bankruptcy court sale to set the value of the property, and this court rejected that attempt. In this case is substantially different from those two cases for several reasons. First, there were substantial improvements made to the property from 2010 to 2013. The existence of the video lottery terminal, the ability to conduct video lottery terminal gaming at the facility came into effect after 2012. And for the first time, the Board of Education presented an appraisal report valuing the real estate in these proceedings. As indicated in our brief, we believe that there were numerous errors conducted by the Board of Tax Appeals in this case. But I'd like to center on two of them, one being the Board of Tax Appeals' total rejection or refusal to even consider the Board of Education's appraisal. And the second is the manner in which the Board of Tax Appeals treated the ability to conduct video lottery gaming at this facility as personal property. In the first instance, dealing with the appraisal, the Board of Education presented the appraisal report of Mr. Douglas Bovard, who presented an income capitalization approach to valuing the real estate. He explained that it is difficult to value real estate in these types of entities because they generally sell as a unit, the real estate and the business together. And in fact, the property owner's own appraisal acknowledged that difficulty. And instead of zeroing in on the real estate and valuing just the real estate, the property owner's appraiser valued the business as a going concern. And then he started to peel off pieces and he gave a value for the business, the goodwill, the furniture and fixtures, subtracted that to arrive at a real estate value. In addition, he subtracted out from the real estate. He placed a $50 million value on the ability to conduct video lottery gaming at that location. And he said, that's not part of the real estate. And he treated that as personal property.
Is your argument that Mr. Sangre's methodology, as you described, valuing the going concern and then subtracting off non-real property assets, are you arguing that that methodology itself is improper as a matter of law, or that the way he carried out that methodology was wrong?
I think the way he carried it out was wrong, and we pointed out multiple errors in the way he carried it out, such as the huge reductions that he gave to comparable sales of other racetracks. When he was arriving at his value, he deducted from the sale of these racetracks, he deducted 50 to 60% of the sale price for supposedly a transfer of the horse racing license, which was never transferred in these sales. And usually when you're dealing with comparable sales, if you're making adjustments of 50 to 60%, that's an indication that your sale is not comparable. That's a huge adjustment for an appraiser to make, and you usually don't see those types of adjustments in comparable sales.
But my recollection is that his comparable sales were other racetracks. Is that not correct?
That is correct.
So why exactly wouldn't those sales be similar to the property at issue, given that the property at issue also involves similar licenses?
Well, first off, the property at issue, the sales did not involve a sale or transfer of the license, because a racetrack, the other properties involved only horse racetrack licenses, not video lottery licenses. Horse racetrack license, as we set forth in our brief, cannot be transferred. They cannot be sold. When you buy a facility that qualifies for a horse race meet, you can apply for a new license. But you don't buy the license from the person that you buy the horse track facility from.
But does that make the fact that the license is not transferable, does that make it part of the real estate, though? I mean, why is it that, could you explain your argument, why just the fact that it's not transferable means that it can't have value to the owner?
Well,
separate from the real estate.
It can have value to an owner because he's conducting a horse race meet at that location, but he can only do it at that location. The license is an integral part of the real estate. Can't be moved to another location. It has value to the owner, okay? But when you're selling the property, when you're selling the real estate, if I own real estate that I have a horse race license at, I can't sell that license. I can certainly sell the track to Mr. Jones. I can't sell the license to him. He has to go to the Racing Commission and apply for a new separate license.
But in
my license doesn't even transfer to him.
But
it's
your,
a new license.
In your example, of if you're selling it, you can't actually transfer the license, but the purchaser, does not the purchaser then acquire the opportunity to acquire a license? And doesn't that the opportunity itself have some value?
Yes, it does. And that's a value of the real estate. Because if you want the opportunity to conduct video lottery gaming at that location or a horse race at that location, you have to purchase a specific item of real estate. There's only 7 items of real estate in the state of Ohio where you can do that. That increases the value of that real estate. It's much like a zoning regulation. If I want to conduct a landfill, I have to buy a piece of property where I can operate the landfill. Even though I have to get a separate license once I buy the property, I have to buy specific property. And that property has value because you can conduct that activity on that location.
Does the licensing for operating a racetrack, are there requirements other than just owning the property?
Yes, there is.
And do those requirements have something to do with who's making the application, who owns the property? Does it have to do with the qualifications of the potential licensee?
It does, Your Honor. You have to have a facility where you can conduct the races. But the ownership of that facility and the people who are managing and conducting the race meets have to meet certain qualifications.
So is that not a difference between licensing and zoning under your example? Whereas zoning, if I own a piece of property, it doesn't really matter who I am or what my qualifications are. If I own the property and the property fits within a particular zoning, that use is automatically approved, whereas a license would be different in that it relates somewhat, at least somewhat, to the qualification of the person.
I would disagree with your analogy, Your Honor. Even with zoning, the property has a permitted use, just like the racetrack facility has a permitted use. But then if I want to perform that use on the property, I have to meet certain other qualifications. In the racetrack situation, I have to get a license from the Racing Commission. I have certain qualifications. If I want to put up a factory on that property that is zoned for industrial, I have to indicate that I have certain qualifications and get certain licensing permits from probably the federal government, the state government, the city governments, which relate not to the fact that that property is zoned or not zoned for industrial, but how I'm going to operate on it and that I'm qualified to operate, much like a, you know, an EPA license. So the ability to operate it on that location, the ability to operate at those seven locations in the state of Ohio, gives value to that property. Before the video lottery gaming license came into effect, there were these thoroughbred horse race tracks, seven of them throughout the state of Ohio. When the state of Ohio exercised its police power to expand the permissible uses of those properties to include video lottery gaming, that increased the value of the properties.
What about the, I think there's evidence in the record about the fact that there was at least the possibility that some of these locations could change. If additional monies were paid to the state, you could essentially abandon the race location, the track location, and then move to a different part of the state. And I think there's evidence that at least one property in Ohio actually did that. How do you reconcile that with your theory that it's all tied to that particular piece of real estate?
Well, in those particular cases, there were four racetracks were permitted to move their race track to a different location. But again, that just merely expanded to four other potential parcels in the state of Ohio. That applied only to the racetrack permit. It did not apply to the video lottery permit or license. You could move the racetrack, but the video lottery regulations required a specific location, the prior location. There was nothing in the regs or the law that says, if I move this track from Cuyahoga County to Akron, that I can conduct video lottery gaming there. I have to apply for a new license. It was only an acknowledgement that if you want to move your race permit, we're going to approve a move to a different location.
But I guess my question is, in that situation, if the racing license moved, at that point you couldn't operate the VLTs there at that original location, correct?
That is correct, because you no longer have a race permit.
So that value associated with the ability to either perform, to have races or to have video lottery terminals, once the racetrack moves, that value essentially vanishes from the original location, right?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor, because the ability to move the racetrack to a new location didn't necessarily preclude obtaining a racing permit for the original location. You could technically get a racing permit for the previous location also. Furthermore, if the property owner decided not to use that location, that's a choice that he made, but there still is the potential to have the race permit at that location because it certainly qualifies for a race meet. It's got all the facilities. Your Honor, I say I only have 2 minutes. Could I reserve that for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones.
Your Honor, may it please the court. Paul Jones on behalf of the taxpayer in this case, Harrah's Ohio Acquisition Company, LLC, now known as Thistledown Racetrack, LLC. As mentioned, this court had previously decided two cases which related to Mr. Sangre's appraisal versus the sale price. The BTA and this court in both of those cases approved Mr. Sangre's values for the real estate as of 1110 and 1112. In this case, not surprisingly, the BTA again approved Mr. Sangre's value for the 1113 date based on the same approaches that had been approved in those prior cases. I want to address three of the issues that were raised in argument just now. The first was Your Honor asked whether Mr. Sangre's approach of valuing a going concern and deducting the other items of property was invalid as a matter of law versus it had to do with the approach that he used. The Board of Education's answer to that was that it was the approach that was questioned, not whether it was invalid as a matter of law. That right there sums up the issue in this case, which is the BTA weighed both of these appraisals. It looked at the appraisal of Mr. Sangre. It looked at the appraisal of Mr. Bovard. It evaluated and weighed those facts and made a factual determination that Mr. Sangre's appraisal was more persuasive and more credible.
Did the BTA really weigh Mr. Bovard's appraisal? I mean, I think there's language in there that basically said, like, something about his approach tainted the entire report, and then it really seemed like the BTA just said it wasn't even really considering his appraisal.
In the decision, Your Honor, yes, in that's one of the BOE's contentions in their brief, was that in the BTA decision itself, there is language from the BTA that explains that Mr. Bovard used a what they call a least fee approach, whereas under 5713.03, the property is to be valued based on the fee simple as unencumbered. And the BTA's view was that because he used no sales comparison approach, he only used the cost approach as a check, he focused solely on an income approach, which used a net lease approach to the property. Basically, he said, I'm going to view this property as if an owner investor has the property and is going to lease it to a gaming operator. And the BTA said that approach is wrong because you're assuming that it's being leased and it's an owner occupied property.
So I guess one of my questions is, so did the BTA weigh the evidence represented in his appraisal, or did it just say, we're not looking at that appraisal and we're not even going to consider that appraisal because of the method he used?
In my view, their decision to disregard it based on that lease fee approach was their weighing of the two. They saw Mr. Sangre's appraisal, which used all three approaches. They reviewed and considered Mr. Bovard's appraisal and decided this approach from the beginning is flawed and fundamentally flawed, and we're not going to discuss it any further in our decision. It wasn't that they didn't consider it. They just said that flaw alone is enough to not have it be credible as to the value. There were plenty of other flaws if they would have determined, hey, this lease fee approach is okay. Let's take a look, let's write it up and talk about it a little further. But they decided based on that alone that it was.
So what if the BTA was wrong regarding that conclusion?
If they were wrong to throw it out from the beginning, then in fact, Mr. Bovard's approach, which was a lease fee approach, assuming a triple net lease by an owner to a gaming operator, the BTA would still conclude, as we've argued at the BTA and in our briefs, that his approach was still invalid because the way he valued under his income approach, the way he valued the property was, number one, to look at rents from leases from the 1980s and 90s of other gaming facilities. He didn't look at any current market rents for a property like this. So he started from a flawed premise, but he also used wrong data.
But how do we know the BTA would have viewed it that way? I mean, the BTA didn't, in its decision, didn't really tell us mm-hmm. sort of what its views were on these details that you're talking about. So how do we know if the BTA was wrong in the way it characterized Bovard's appraisal? Mm-hmm. How do we know then that it would have still rejected it and found Mr. Sangre's appraisal to be the better, have more weight? How do we know that?
Well, this court knows that by a basic review of the record and the briefs, because although the BTA wrote up its decision and stopped by saying this is a lease fee approach, we're not going to give it any further discussion in our opinion, There is ample evidence and argument in the record that the approach itself, even if it was considered a valid approach, was wrong because of this issue of the rents and then also the issue of his capitalization rates, which is where I was going next.
And I appreciate your argument, but isn't this court limited to what the BTA said in its decision rather than itself going into the record and sort of surmising as to what the BTA would have determined had it gone far, a little further in its analysis?
Well, this court is, in terms of this court's review, the issue would be whether the beat in the, I think it's the Cleveland Public Library case where the court's basically saying we need to see more from the BTA on this. That's a distinguishable case here because we do have ample discussion in the decision of what happened. I mean, if we're looking at the decision, it does talk about quite some length why they decided to disregard Bovard's approach. It wasn't just that they summarily overlooked that. They do discuss it, and it's in the supplement. Supplement pages 15 and 16, but it's a couple of paragraphs where the BTA got into that decision.
But the substance of those paragraphs, mm-hmm. to me, seems to be all about its characterization as his appraisal as a least fee appraisal. And that gets back to, well, what if they're wrong about that? I mean, I think your argument seems to be more focused on details that really aren't reflected in the decision, in those two paragraphs of the decision.
They did not discuss those details in the decision itself, but in my view, that's a, for this court, it's a decision of, is that something that, this court has said, it doesn't require, basically a technical recital of every single fact and finding in the BTA decision. The BTA merely needs to discuss how it arrived at its conclusion. So for this court to order the BTA to go further than it did is something that's unnecessary because they made their decision based on the lease fee approach, which they found to be wrong.
And I want to ask you also regarding the question of the BTA's characterization of Mr. Bovard's appraisal as a leased fee appraisal, what is your response? I think in the school board's brief, they refer to the Meyer case, which in along with a case from New York that seems to approve of that sort of approach. What's your response to that?
In terms of the application of Meyer and the two New York cases, what's our
yes, idea? I mean, just the idea that that an appraiser, I think, typically is would come up with a hypothetical lease in an income capitalization approach to determine a value. The Meyer case seems to say that sort of approach is okay. How is this case different from that?
The difference here is that in the Meyer case, you're talking about an appraisal that looked at multiple approaches: sales, income, and cost. In this case, Bovard did not look at a sales comparison approach, even though there were several sales of racetracks in Ohio. He admitted in his testimony they only used the cost approach as a check. He relied solely on the income approach, which is an appropriate method. That's what Mr. Sangre used. But Mr. Sangre's income approach focused on an owner-occupied gaming facility, not a hypothetical lease situation, because in his view, there was no data out there. Mr. Bovard, in this case, used that lease fee approach, but he had to go back to the 1980s and 90s to find data. He had nothing current to even prove market value.
So are you arguing that it's not so much his approach, his method, but it's the fact that some of the data underlying his method wasn't really there.
That would be the distinction between the Meyer case and this one, is that his data was completely flawed because it used old leases. They weren't market. He didn't prove that they were market or current. He also assumed a percentage of revenues, as a 4% of revenues would be the rent amount based on these leases from the 80s and 90s, but then used a capitalization rate similar to a Walgreens triple net investment property, which is completely different than a 350,000 square foot gaming facility, which is highly regulated. And he admitted in his testimony, 13 to 14% would be a more appropriate cap rate for that, not an 8% or 7% of a Walgreens.
But these details that you're talking about, mm-hmm. the BTA didn't talk about any of this, correct?
They did not talk about this in their decision. There is ample evidence and argument about it in the record, but they did not discuss that in the decision itself.
The BTA pretty much just stopped short once it saw the method itself and said, we're not going to dig into it any further. Into the stuff that you're referring to.
I agree with that, Your Honor. In their decision itself, they ended their discussion with the fact that it was a flawed lease fee approach. That was true because what he did was to look at old leases that weren't applicable. He did not do the same type of approach that Mr. Sangre did, which was to look at the other gaming facilities that would be comparable to this property. So Mr. Sangre's income approach was a more credible approach in their view, and they didn't need to discuss it any further, which is why their decision does stop short at that, but it was a correct decision to stop short. If they were to go further, there are additional reasons why it would have been flawed. I also wanted to revisit quickly this notion about what's included in their decision itself, which is that the BTA itself did have plenty of discussion about the fundamental problems with Bovard's approach, which are supported by the record. And that they did have sufficient discussion and that they need not go through every single finding in their decisions. In sum, the taxpayer would ask that this court approve the Board of Tax Appeals decision that approved the Sangre value opinion of $22 million as of the January 1, 13 date.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Konzer, you've saved 1 minute and 42 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, I think as this court is starting to sense, it's clear the BTA simply rejected Mr. Bovard's appraisal. They did no discussion of his appraisal, of his data, whether they liked his data, didn't like his data. They just concluded he did a leased fee, and that's an inappropriate approach. So we're not going to further discuss the appraisal. This court in Meyer case clearly said that when you have owner-occupied property, you can do an income approach to valuation, and that income approach can be by using market rents to assume a hypothetical lease on the property. That's what Mr. Bovard did. He said based on his experience, he has market rents for racetrack properties, gambling facilities that rent out, and then he did a triple net lease and did an income approach to valuation, checked it with his cost approach.
If the court were to agree with your argument about Mr. Bovard's appraisal, what are you requesting? Are you requesting a remand to the BTA, or what is it that you want the court to do?
Well, if the court would only agree on the approach, the handling of the Bovard appraisal, then it should be remanded to the BTA for further findings and analysis of all of the issues that Mr. Jones raised. Did the BTA consider Mr. Bovard's appraisal more credible than Mr. Sangre's? Because they didn't do that analysis. However, there are other errors raised in the brief, such as the manner in which Mr. Sangre deducted value for the VLT license that we feel if the court finds in our favor on that point, it shows that Mr. Sangre's analysis is incorrect and should be rejected. In that case, the court could adopt the valuation of Mr. Bovard because it is a correct approach to valuing the property. On a point that the court raised when I was previously up here before Mr. Jones, dealing with the licensing, there are some cases cited in our brief, such as St. Bernard Storage, in the Harvard Refuse case that indicated where when you have licenses or an ability such as a license to conduct an activity on a property, a state-issued license, or a company franchise, if that is so integrally tied to that real estate and it cannot be sold separately, like the licenses here, that becomes a part of the real estate value, not something else. And that's why we feel that Mr. Sangre's valuation and deduction of the VLT value from the real estate was improper. That's a part of the real estate value. Thank you.
Thank you. This case will be submitted and you'll be advised of the court's decision.